Well, the occasion for this morning's meeting of the Church of Jesus Christ is the so-called energy crisis. And there are two foci for our consideration. One is the situation. And there is no situation, but the situation, as I see it, is represented by these two books, Mankind at the Turning Point, which is the Second Club of Rome report, and A Time to Choose, which is the Ford Foundation Energy Project. Took 2 years, $4 million for that study of what the situation is. That's one of the foci, and the other is our faith. And they are one thing. They're not two separate things, as Larry Rasmussen reminded us at breakfast. The Club of Rome is an international group of businessmen and scientists who became concerned about the limits of growth, and their first study was called The Limits of Growth. And this second report is prepared by a group that's centered around Case Western University and Hanover University in Germany. And they are convinced that we have a serious choice to make between the development of solar energy and nuclear energy. They think that the choice of nuclear energy is a Faustian bargain. For the short-term advantage of nuclear energy, we are selling our souls. They separate out those who are concerned with energy and locate one group, what they call the technological optimists, who hold that the solution can be found by using nuclear energy. That is the solution to the energy crisis, the energy shortage. In 50 years or so, they say, the combination of fast breeders, the fast breeder reactor, with high temperature gas cool reactors, and hydrogen technology, which is the way you will transport the energy, should satisfy all of our energy needs. And in the meantime, we can meet our energy needs by using oil for transportation and coal and gas for heating. Thus, we can get by with only a small dent in our economic growth. A bit of shifting, they say, from consumption to investment. In the next 100 years, then, we will be building 4 nuclear reactors each week and replacing 2 reactors each day. And they think that we could produce enough energy, or at least it's claimed by the technological experts, we could produce enough energy for the world with 24,000 worldwide reactors. That would mean we'd have about 50 nuclear installations in every state of the Union. The cost is, and the continual displacement is estimated about $2 trillion per year, which is 60% of the present world output. But with growth in production income, that doesn't seem to be too large a problem. The problems of, at least we can ignore for the time being, the problems of safe storage of the nuclear waste and the discard equipment. But we cannot ignore, they say, the problems involved in the transportation and the use of the nuclear materials themselves. In order to operate 24,000 breeder reactors, which is the way we're going now, we would need to process and transport, they say, every year 15 million kilograms of plutonium-239, the core material of the Hiroshima atomic bomb. And they say, and there's a great deal of controversy about this, only 10 pounds of the element are needed to construct a bomb. As long as this plutonium is not inhaled or otherwise introduced into the bloodstream, it can be safely handled without any significant radiological effects. But if inhaled, 10 micrograms, 1 microgram gram is 1/1,000,000 of a gram, is likely to cause fatal lung cancer. And a ball of plutonium the size of a grapefruit contains enough poison to kill nearly all the people living today. Moreover, plutonium has a radioactive life of more than 24,000 years. Obviously, with so much plutonium on hand, there will be a tremendous problem of safeguarding the nuclear parks. Not one or two, but 3,000 of them, and they will be located everywhere in every nation. So they conclude that we are making a Faustian bargain. Now that's one consideration as we meet together as the Church of Jesus Christ. This interpretation of our situation, let me make it clear, it's an interpretation of our situation. It's only one interpretation. A second consideration is the framework within which we consider an issue such as energy. And I'm not really going to develop that this morning, but as we move along through this week, we have to consider the framework of our faith within which we consider this. Karl Barth used to say, you take the newspaper in one hand and the Bible in the other hand. What I'm suggesting today, you know, is that we take these two books in one hand and the Bible in the other, and as we go through the week, we look at what that means. Now, I want to develop this week five propositions, and they're, like all assertions of anybody in the community of faith, they are exploratory. They are what we call confessions. They are not representing the truth. They are representing where I stand as of this morning when I wrote them out, although I've been thinking about them for a while, and not too long. I really didn't get involved in this until about 4 months ago, and then it seemed to me to be something worth attending to, just to start attending to it. First, for the present, we should stop building nuclear power plants and helping other countries build them. Second, we should develop a program of energy conservation. Third, we should develop alternatives to nuclear energy, particularly solar energy. Fourth, a new ethos is required. That is, an ethos in which there's a global approach to all problems and in which there is a search for the meaning of what we are about, the meanings which are leading to an energy-intensive society, what I call the religious problem, the problem of the meaning of our being. It seems to me we have to reconsider the meaning of our being. And fifth, new economic and political institutions are involved. And each day I will try to focus on one of these, although we may get stopped along the way. First, then, we should declare a moratorium on the building of nuclear power plants here and around the world. Why are we building these parks? Well, I think we're building these parks because, in the first place, nuclear energy is cheaper. It's really cheaper. And in the second place, because fossil fuel, coal, oil, and gas are in short supply, and they will be in shorter supply. You can take any estimate you want, but I say at the most we've got 50 years supply at the present growth rates. So that's the Club of Rome report says we've got 30 years supply, and it varies with different estimates, and nobody is quite sure, and you get arguments on all sides. Third, we need to be self-sufficient in energy, and our dependence on oil leads to the kind of situation that we saw where the Arabs, and we still are with, where the Arabs can determine whether or not we're going to get oil. Fourth, nuclear plants are clean. That is to say, they are clean insofar as the air is concerned, the pollutants, not so far as radiation, although the radiation may not be a great problem. But the kind of pollutants that the fossil fuel plants spew off into the air are not there. So it's that. And I suppose I had one down here. We build nuclear plants because we can. I think in America we tend to do what we can. If we can go to the moon, we go to the moon. Okay, now should we build nuclear plants? And I have seven objections here, Some are more important than others. Actually, when we were talking about this the other day, one of the guests here is a specialist on nuclear plants. He works for Bechtel. They build most of the nuclear plants, most of the power plants, as a matter of fact, but they build almost all of the nuclear plants, if not all. I didn't get clear whether they built them all. And he's the specialist who is in charge of the environmental effects of nuclear plants and the processes which protect the environment from the reaction. So he spent 9 months in a hearing in Minneapolis on building that plant, arguing for the building of the plant. So that I spent 2.5 hours with him hearing his side of the story. And he's very open and will give you all the objections and then he'll give you his answers. So I'm kind of giving you partly the result of that. But there's a vast literature on this subject, and this is a very good, it's a textbook, but it gives you references to all the arguments for and against, what the problems are. You can see it later. There are a number of things coming out, courses. I've got a couple of other textbooks that are now out that are used by people in courses. Well, let me just run through these and then we'll talk a little about them. The first objection is the radiation pollution from normal operations is dangerous. The second is the malfunctioning of the system will lead to accidents that cause death and excessive radiation. The third is sabotage. The plants can be sabotaged. And that, of course, then leads to all the problems that the malfunctioning do. Fourth, terrorists can steal radioactive materials and use them for blackmail. Fifth, the heat given off in the process will cause thermal pollution. Sixth, the waste products cannot be disposed of safely. And seventh, they are inefficient. But let's start now. The radiation pollution from normal operations is dangerous. I don't consider that to be a serious objection. And one could go into the amount of it, but I remember that Leo Bustad, who will be here, we had a session 3 years ago with four of us, and Leo said, well, there's no more radiation given off if you stand at the edge of one of these plants than if you flew from California to Washington, where he was attending the Atomic Energy Commission meetings as a specialist. He was a specialist in the effects of radiation, studying the effects of all kinds of bomb explosions. So I kind of dismiss that. The second one is the malfunctioning of the system will lead to accidents that cause death and excessive radiation. Now this is a more difficult one to evaluate. Dick Anderson, the specialist, said, and he described the issue. The problem is that if you don't have the system cooled properly, the core will get so hot that the whole thing will melt. And then you'll have all that exposure. And the problem then is whether or not there's adequate protection. And people, you know, keep citing the Detroit project where there was a meltdown. A little piece got stuck in the system somehow and caused the cooling system not to work. And there was a meltdown. Now, Dick says, and I take him very seriously, he's a part of our community. He is a part of the church, trying to respond responsibly to this, that you have the core in which the radioactive material is placed, and that's a protection. And then you have the cooling systems that work on that. You have a primary system that puts water on this core and keeps it cool. And then they don't know, of course, what will happen if the core, if the water didn't the core they're using now, at least, if that didn't work because they've never tried it. Says core has never melted, really. That is the kind of core they're using now. Then they have five or six pumps, any one of which would work. And they have all kinds of devices, of course, to protect. If the off-site power fails, then they have three sets of diesels, any one of which will work to propel the water, the cooling system. And then outside of the core, they have a containment system of concrete or steel, so that if the core melts, it's contained within this. Now, if the core melted, he said, the people inside would be killed, and the dose at the border would be about 25 rems, and that's about the amount that the astronauts got when they went to the moon, and that's a lot, but according to him, it isn't a great amount. And a lot would depend in terms of the effect on what happens or what the weather is. That is, if the weather is very calm and still, then that cloud will maintain itself. Otherwise, it will be dispersed in the atmosphere. And he says there are already 6 tons of plutonium in the atmosphere from the bombs that have been exploded. So one accident wouldn't increase the amount of plutonium greatly. Now, there's a great deal of difference about these facts. And I saw this article in the paper the other day about a group of scientists for the American Physical Society, whatever they call it, APS, that made a report, and they said that if there were a meltdown, large amounts of radiation from plants now in use could be expected to cause 10,000 to 20,000 deaths from cancer over a 10-year period instead of the 300 suggested by a government sponsored group. I only cite this indicate that the scientists and the so-called experts are in great disagreement about the effects. And I don't know how you make up your mind. You know, you've got a continuum of those who are very, very, very alarmed and those who see it as a kind of normal risk that is not too great. This is 12 scientists' finding based on a year's study were made public at the American Physical Society. Now, Dick said that 95% of the scientists would be on his side. And Dick, of course, working for the company that manufactures them, I take what he says with a grain of salt. He has a real interest in it. But I also take him seriously as a person. And what we have then is a great divergence of opinion about the likelihood that the core will melt and will have this accident, and the results of it, that is, the effects of it, even if it does occur. Okay, that's a problem. That is the malfunctioning of the system, the normal malfunction. Now, there's a great deal of divergence also in opinion about the possibility of sabotage. Whether or not the plants can be sabotaged, whether or not it can be blown up, or whether in some artificial way this material, this radioactive material, can be released. And that seems to be not anything that we can simply assume. Now, when I first began to read, it really seemed to me it was really possible, but when you talk to Dick and you think about the processes, he says, for example, when they ship the plutonium, you have to ship the plutonium in a fast breeder reactor every once in a while to a processing plant in which they enrich it. They separate out some of the isotopes and get a concentration of a certain form, He said they ship it in casks, 75-ton casks, that can only be opened underwater. You're dead if you don't open them underwater. So the question of how you could sabotage that becomes a real issue. How you could get some of that plutonium out. He also says, of course, part of his argument is that there are 500,000 pounds of plutonium in our weapon system already. So that if you're talking about sabotage, you've already got a lot of plutonium lying around, and to be sure we're adding to it, but it isn't as if there weren't any around for people to steal, you know, or to blow up. And I'm already into my fourth point, of course, the terrorists can steal this. I guess, I haven't got it in here, but the blackmail I think that's important is from the small countries. And there's a great deal of material now on what it takes to manufacture a bomb. That's what is involved in using plutonium and enriching it, as they call it, until it can be useful in a bomb. What we've done in some countries, Egypt, Iran, India, is to ship them the materials for a nuclear station, but insist upon surveillance. And with those countries, we know exactly where the plutonium is. I don't know whether we know exactly, but at least we have the right to, and according to some reports, we have constant surveillance. But we didn't ship it to Israel, so France provided them with the material. So they've got it, and everybody that I know of that knows much about it thinks that Israel's got the bomb, got bombs, and now Egypt is going that way. And of course, as long as Israel has them and Egypt doesn't, I'm sure that's a part of what's involved in all these negotiations. But this is the kind of world we are building by virtue of developing nuclear plants. Every country then that has a nuclear plant will have the possibility, granted some problems in technology. The difference, there are a couple of technologies. One costs $1 trillion and one $1 billion to build. No, that's not right. One costs $1 billion and one costs 100 million. And so they're now saying with this new technology, 100 million, some of the countries that couldn't afford the other will be able to do it. That's more of a problem for me, but I don't know how you deal with that. The waste, well, let's go to the waste, which I think is the other problem. What do you do with the waste? And the argument is that they cannot really be safely disposed of. And there are three proposals to dispose of them. One is to bury them in the salt mines in Kansas, and they're involved in various controversies as to what kinds of safeguards have to be introduced before they're buried there. And this book gives the arguments for using salt mines. And another one is to shoot it off to the sun. And granted, you don't have a mistake in your firing system. You can get rid of it. And you got all the statistical probabilities that it won't get off. And the other is to bury it in the water, in the sea. And there's a place in the sea where somehow the bottom of the sea is kind of being folded down underneath, and that seems to be a possibility. But there is a problem in disposal, and so one of the reasons one might go for fusion as over against fission that is fission, separation, fusion, putting together, one of the reasons you might go is because there's no problem with a meltdown and there are no waste products of the process. You have the radioactive equipment that they say has to be disposed of every 20 years, and that's about 15,000 kilograms, and that has to be disposed of and put somewhere, but that's a lesser problem. You no problem with sabotage, no problem with radiation, except for the disposal of the equipment. Well, that's kind of the situation that I see, and so I guess for me at present, given the situation, that this seems to be a controversial issue, and the specialists don't agree, and it is possible for us to work toward a program of conservation, so we won't need in the near future to expand our energy production, that we ought to call for a moratorium on the building of nuclear power plants. So that's my conclusion at this moment on the basis of looking at the arguments pro and con for the building of them. And I leave you with that. Maybe some of you are specialists in this area.
They're going to build one there. It's been passed to build one up where I live. And people that were pro and con for such strange reasons. I mean, it really didn't have too much to do with, but people that were against it, it had a lot to do with the leakage and those kind of problems. People that were for it wanted it because there'd be more jobs. I mean, you know, it really didn't have anything to do with the energy problem.
Yeah. So, well, it's,
yeah, I mean, it was hard to argue with them because they were hungry, you know.
Now that, of course, connects it with our whole social system.
How does it relate to solar energy? Is solar energy a long-term development?
Well, we don't have the technology, I'm told, to
could we get it?
Use. Well, it's like a lot of other things. We don't know whether we could get it. But the money at present is not being put into it, into solar energy. It's being put into the breeder reactor. And a little money into conservation, a little bit into solar. But it's like the development of anything else. It won't develop unless you put the money into it. And so my position is that we should have a moratorium and put all our research money into solar energy. And it's clear we could develop all kinds of things. One of the problems, of course, is the amount of space it would take. According to Club of Rome, it would take 1% of the Earth's surface to provide the equivalent of 200 billion barrels of oil a year. And right now we are using what? We are using about 19 billion barrels of oil a year here, but you get 200, which would be enough energy, their claim is, to take care of the world's needs with solar energy.
But is there any, they say anything about the development of some of these fast-growing carbons? Heard a report from one of the university extensions about some kind of grass that you can grow that
could be used.
That is burnable. That
burnable.
Produces.
I don't know much about. I've explored a little bit geothermal and wind, tides, and that sort of thing. And they don't. Geothermal is a real possibility, I think. But you've got all the problems of the shift. You pump the water down into the earth where it's hot, and it comes back as steam. And there are a few experimental plants that are doing that. That's a possibility. But I don't know about the grass. I don't know any statistics or anything on the burning of vegetation to get. When you think of the burning of wood, and the problem and the lack feasibility of that, you know, for our total energy need, I assume right now that that's not very feasible. It might be a supplement. Of course, there's burning of garbage, there's all kinds of things that are involved as conservation measures and as supplements. But I don't think any of those, geothermal is the one exception that I know of that has a possibility of creating a lot of energy.
There was some work done in Nebraska on using grain alcohol in with gasoline, about 20% of the volume, and using it for the internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm. Is the part of the real, from where I sit, what I hear is part of the real crux is the ethos of conservation. Can that mentality be introduced?
That's really part of the problem, because if you're not willing to conserve and to develop the measures for conservation, you will, I think, give in to the pressure to keep the GNP going for nuclear energy, and it's this kind of thing for jobs and so forth. You know? Unless you have your system functioning in such a way that you don't undermine too much the standard of living, you will go for the nuclear energy. Now, the Ford proposal, they have three scenarios in there. One, that you take the historic growth in the use of energy. One, that you, what they call a technical fix, in which you have a conservation program. And the other one is that you go for a zero energy growth program. And they come down in the middle. So that
historic growth is the middle one?
No, historic growth would be just following the pattern. In 73, we used about 75 quadrillion BTUs, and we would use by 2000 about 185 quadrillion. And in the historical growth, you would use about 116. I mean, in the technical fix, you use 116. And in the zero growth, you'd level off at 100 quadrillion BTUs.
The technical fix, the middle one?
Yeah, the middle one. So their proposal is that, and you can do this kind of conservation, they say, without affecting the GNP very greatly. 4%. Their projection is that you could, with conservation, by 2000, you would have a 4% decrease in the GNP, as over against what it would be in historical growth. That's a projection, you see. But the question is, two questions, I think, well, there are really three questions. One is why the need for the growth in the GNP. The second one, why not conservation, since it's not going to affect the GNP very much? Why not conservation? And the third is, what are the dangers of nuclear power? But you see, you could come from the other end and say, well, why do we want so much growth? And if we can get the growth with conservation, why not conserve? Anyway, I mean, regardless of what's involved in nuclear energy.
Conservation would be the first example of limiting growth.
It would not limit growth very much, you see. It is a program which changes the use of energy. We'll get into this tomorrow in detail, but in conservation, you would, for example, require in some way or other that automobiles, you know, and gradual increase over the years till you've got 30, 40 miles a gallon, which is technologically possible. And then you insulate your home. There are three or four, and then you would institute heat-conserving devices where energy is used in industry. Those are three major ways in which we could conserve enough energy so that it would reduce the amount of energy used by 2,000 by the difference between 116 quadrillion and 185 quadrillion, just by those three measures.
Do you reduce it enough to take off the demand for all nuclear power plants?
Well, that's a question, you see. That's
politically, you're going to have to be able to deliver a certain amount of power, I assume, over the next 25 years in order to...
That's a question, and that involves, of course, solar energy. Involves several things. It involves the relation to fossil fuels and to the world market and the possibility of getting fossil fuels outside the United States. That's part of what's involved. And in the Second Club of Rome report, they say what we ought to do is make a bargain with the Arab countries on the short term and use the fossil fuel while we give them other solar energy and other devices so that they will continue to have an income. That is, it's a problem for them, you see, in terms of their income. And in exchange, that in a sense, they make it into a global problem and say you'll never be able to handle this thing alone.
Is there a great deal of government money going into, I assume there is, just from the insurance angle alone, but I just wonder, into the construction and research of nuclear power plants now?
Well, the last energy bill, I think, is $491 million or something like that. It's not a great big...
A year.
It's not a great big amount that's going into
it. Pretty much
but I don't know how much else is involved. It's hard to know where all the money is going, in terms of armaments and the military and how much that is actually contributing to it. I really don't know the answer to that question.
I mean, does Puget Power or local outfits, do they get the matching funds or guarantees or insurance and that sort of thing?
Well, there are all kinds of things. One bill reduces the liability for nuclear plants to a certain figure in case of any accident, and so they are. And of course, you've got all the money that's already gone into it in terms of research and development, which made it possible. That is all the costs over the years that have gone into the manufacture of the bomb. Everything that went into the manufacture of the bomb is background for the manufacture of nuclear energy. So the cost to the society has to be figured in terms of everything we've done in nuclear power, nuclear control, nuclear development.
You need a military reason to develop solar energy.
That's right. That's right. If you had a military reason for it, you'd get the money poured into it. Now, the reason that might pour your money into that is the need to have, you know, be independent on energy. And again, it's a question of a short term versus a long term, because varying estimates. But see, uranium is not, our supply of uranium is not indefinite. And of course, you've got all kinds of problems there in terms of what you mean by supply. If the price goes up, there's more, and you can afford to process more. But one of the advantages of the breeder reactor is that the light water reactor is about 7% efficient in the using of uranium. That's what Dick said. I've heard 1% or 2%, but he said 7%. And then the fast breeder reactor, which Bill is in Congress now to get the money for it, for pushing the research, is anywhere from 60 to 90% efficient in the use of uranium. So if you go from 1 to 90%, if you take the outside, you're extending the use of your uranium a long time. And the resources are not indefinite. The technical knowledge is so difficult to come by because, I at first said, well, we ought to go fusion. If you're going to have a choice, go fusion. There's plenty of hydrogen. Plenty of water, which they use, and so you don't have the problem of the supply of uranium, and you don't have all the problems. You only have the problem of the disposal of the plant in the end. So I would go fusion. See, I would say moratorium and then go fusion if you got to go that way, but preferably go solar.
Okay.
I guess I really decided you ought to go solar. If you're going to put the money in, put it there. And not even take that intermediate step of fusion. But fusion is so much better in my estimation, but it's not developed, see. And so if you get the pressure of the market, and that's what we're under, we're under the pressure of a market system which wants cheap energy, and the people who demand that energy, and a growth of from 4 to 7% in our energy consumption each year, it's that pressure which will send us to the short range thing. The if you take a market position, if it's only a market, if it's not a political decision, we will go breed a reactor. We'll go the light water reactor and the breeder reactor, and we are going that way. This is in the cards. It is the way we're going, and the predictions are that it will increase by 1985 tenfold the use of nuclear power, and by 2000 twentyfold. It's just there. There's no way to do it. It's as I said the other day. It's like Vietnam. We unless we get control of it as a people, that's the way it's going. Unless it becomes a political issue, and the people put the pressure on the Congress, and it becomes a political issue, the market will take it. And the market, and it's difficult to get the people pressure because recently they're debating what to do about automobiles, and Detroit put on the pressure. It was an economic pressure not to increase the mileage rate, and so I don't know what they finally settled on, but you could say 30 miles an hour, and they're going to say 17, 18, be an increase for our car certainly, but the old car we have, about 10, 12 miles a gallon. But so you gotta have the cars built, and I don't think they'll be built, and I don't think people will buy the cars that go 30 miles. Some will. We're going to buy a car, the next one that goes 30 miles an hour. But to get a car that's big enough and heavy enough so you feel a little protected is difficult. They say they can replace the engine with aluminum engine and save 500 pounds on a car. So the size will be there. They'll save that weight and hence save on the gasoline. And it'll cost you some more, but in terms of the amount of money you save on gasoline, it's a good investment. But see, those pressures are not from the market. So one of the problems we have actually is, what system of interpretation do you use for making these decisions? And I've come to believe that the market system is just not capable of handling this kind of a situation. The market, play market. Now, there are various ways of handling it. If you put a tax on gasoline so it costs $2 a gallon, you would still be using the market, but not a free market. It would be a market mechanism for rationing and so forth, and for getting people to change. You wouldn't be forcing them to change like you would force them to change if you would say the cars have to go 30 miles an hour. So you got a little bit you got a great debate as to how to handle the situation if you decide that you need to get conservation. And you'd get a lot of insulation too if oil went up that much. You really get insulation. You would, in other words, the way to get these three conservation programs, which I meant to talk about tomorrow, and we will, could be that you simply make the price such that people will do it. The alternative is to set regulations, so homes have to have certain insulation.
Is a combination system impractical? I mean, where you have fossil fuel and some breeder reactor?
Yeah, all kinds of combinations are possible.
And they, so that there would be a limit rather than a moratorium, a limit on development of reactors.
Well, I think that's a decision.
Or do you opt for the moratorium because we already have enough to be a supplemental system but the other.
Yeah, I would opt for the moratorium on the thesis that we should make the adjustments that are necessary to live with that system. It would, of course, put the price of oil and coal up if you weren't going the nuclear way, because the supplies would be shorter, so it would cost more. See, that's when the market system wants the cheapest way, and we want the cheapest way, and the nuclear is the cheapest way with a shortage in fossil fuels. So it would really cause an increase in the cost, and so you've got an increase in cost and therefore a decrease in your standard of living. We don't want to face the problem of a decrease in our standard of living for the most part. We are, of course, with the food prices and prices generally with inflation. Generally, we're facing it. But this would really be a decrease. And it depends a little on... some estimates say that and I don't know what it means, but they say the upper group spends 4% of its income on fuel and the lower group 15% when you take heat and transportation into account. I don't know which those groups are. That's just a figure. You know, you get all those figures thrown at you. All it says is it's going to fall on the poor people much heavier than it is the rich people if you go this way. That is, if you raise the price of fuel. So you get a lot of debate as to which way we should go, whether we should build in some way, you know, coupons for everybody so there's a certain amount available, or whether you should have a negative income tax or something like that as a way of taking care of poverty generally or poor people generally. I think you know, our decision, I think, is really a very serious one about whether we think that the dangers involved in nuclear power are such that we really ought to declare this moratorium. I don't know how you feel. I'm not about to take a poll, but I just think there's a decision involved here that's very serious. And I don't think it need be at this time a kind of once and for all decision. I think it's a decision in the light of the present situation, the possibility, you see, of postponing some of these decisions until we know more about it. And I don't know when we'll ever know enough about it, but at least until it becomes a public issue, like Vietnam, until it's debated and you get pro and con and you know where people stand and you know what groups of people and what knowledge is available. And it really becomes what I think. I see no other way in some of these major things for us to go. The alternative is to take the technical experts or to take Congress and turn over your life to some technocrat. And I'm not willing to do that. Now, see, I say I'm a second-class layman in terms of my knowledge of this right now. A year from now, I'll be maybe a first-class layman. But we just have to take some of these issues, I think, and attend to them. I think the church, see, this is where I think the body of Christ is simply got to take an issue like this and attend to it. And not with any great fanfare. I think you get a lot of people who are just out on a limb, but you get such different statements on very flimsy ground that we simply need to attend to it without falling into the need to do anything except, I think, for the time being, declare a moratorium, and that I think we could do in the light of a controversy. Well, if you've got a controversy, I figure, if you can do it without a great deal of damage, why not postpone the decision until it can be made with some intelligence? Then, you see, we would have to face the problem of jobs and other things. The question would be whether this is the way to go to get jobs, or whether we go some other way to get the job and protect kind of basic income for people. Personally, I'd be for a guarantee of a basic income for people. So we don't have these kinds of pressures on us, either personally or from people around us. How does some of the rest of you feel?
I tend to agree, but I think the problem with it is that coming out with a moratorium, unless you have a short-term answer alternative, is probably impractical. I think it's pretty easy out here. We've got water power, you've got some alternatives out here, but what do you do in the heat wave in New York City and the cold winters when you have a blackout or a brownout like they had a few years ago, and all of a sudden people are saying, who turned off the switch? And you see, well, that some guys up here that were yelling and screaming about shutting down the power plant, not that they had any real hard and fast answers, but they had this sort of fear that something was going to happen. And right now, that seems to be the state of the criticism. I'm not criticizing that, but it seems to me you've got to give them something alternative. I don't think you're going to be able to shut the power down in the next 25, 30 years. I think conservation is going to be a long-term hard lesson that's probably going to have to be learned the hard way if it's going to be effective at all. And we got into this a month ago. It's very interesting in a film, and some people are being quite active in the anti-nuclear power. And there are just so many hard decisions and hard problems that need hard answers. I just don't know. I'm in favor of the moratorium, but I don't know how you sell that without something else. The thing I had in mind was that if you go out and build all these nuclear power plants now, and they develop fusion 10 years, 15 years down the pike, they come up with a breakthrough that they're going to be able to do it effectively. Now you've got so many dollars invested in the fusion plants that it's almost going to be impossible to convert just for that reason alone, which makes it another reason that moratorium would be, I think, intelligent. But
if you want to get the money invested, then
yeah,
use it.
Yeah, but I don't know.
California is an interesting place now with our initiative form of writing legislation on trying to get on the ballot a vote on exactly this question, moratorium on power. And having watched the process work, like with coastline protection and environmental issues like that, I think you really kind of encouraged me to about that whole process, because that's what we have. You can't be cynical about it and say that the decision will be reduced to Henry Fonda making spots for the initiative and John Wayne making spots against it, and it will be decided that way. But I think that that's a pretty good way of testing the will of the people, and but it requires a real steadfastness to take that process seriously and to really work with it. And if the church has something to bring to it, maybe it's not only arousing people but also sustaining them in doing that.
Well, I think even if you lose, it becomes a way of being faithful.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't have to win every issue. If I did, I would be lost, because I've lost most of the issues over the years.
Yeah.
But I guess I feel there's something involved in being faithful. And furthermore, in developing a public, we have turned over the decisions in this country. Vietnam just opened my eyes to the fact that we turned over, and I was worse. I was in the freedom movement. I said, I don't want to have anything to do with that. I just let that thing go. And fortunately, there were a lot of other people who thought it was more important than the freedom movement.
Do you think that the people, you know, like each of us in our own little families, our own little groups, deciding to do something differently, you know, like not using our clothes dryers or air conditioners, elevators, that kind of thing. I mean, that doesn't make any real impact on the amount of energy used. I mean, I suppose the percentage is just so little in that way. But,
yeah. Well, I believe in doing that. You know, we sold our second car and take the bus and so forth. I believe in doing that. I believe in doing that. We'll get into that in the fourth session because I believe in the change of lifestyle, which requires a kind of new ethos, a new way of looking at materials, a new way of looking at resources, and getting involved in that personal way. Now, I don't think that the amount of energy saved, generally speaking, in other words, we got to get cars to go 30 miles an hour, and they ought not to be produced if they don't go 30 miles an hour. And you can make an individual decision, and that's going to be effective. But it seems to me we have, you know, you have a personal kind of decision, and then you have a collective kind of decision. And I know that you can make a lot of personal decisions and they don't affect the collective, and you've got to make both. So I'm for making both.
Right.
I'm just for beginning to get involved with a new way of looking at things. Because if we don't get a new way of looking at things, ultimately, we're not going to be able to legislate as a collective and get changes. It has to be a combination of things where there's a new spirit. Where a spirit, and a spirit that's very concrete, permeates a culture so that we have a new way of looking at these materials and the meaning of these materials.
But boy, that requires so much affirmation and encouragement and support, you know, even in these personal things that you're trying to change. It really points to the church too, I think, you know, because sometimes I feel the church kind of reinforcing my apathy about that, and the need to find places where you draw, you know, some kind of support that's celebrative, that's affirmative, you know, and also that's a sharing, you know, so you get in touch with people who are, you know, have some other things to show you or give you.
Well, I really think that, the reason I chose energy to attend to in part is because I thought it would drive us to the meaning of our being. Mm-hmm. And quicker than anything else. So you could take food. Food is really a crucial, critical problem in the world with, I estimate 500 million, and this report estimates, got a terrific chapter on food, but somehow that doesn't directly get into our beings quite so fast. It's like being a missionary for the Africans or something, and not dealing with race here. You can kind of deal with food out there and I think ultimately it will get you the same way, but I think...
Right, because it's energy.
But I think you'll get there faster with energy toward the problem of the meaning of our being. Now, I think the energy issue is important in itself, but it's also a way of the church asking, what's the meaning of the being of the Church of Jesus Christ in terms of what we do with our created opportunity, with the gift of life? What do we do with it? And that's why I said that finally you ask, why do we use so much energy? What's the meaning of it? And if you don't get to that, I think we'll never get underneath it. That's why I think the personal approach is a way which begins to, you've got to ask that question of yourself. If you begin to do all these things, you've got to change the meanings that you have. Ask those questions. So I really think it's a great way of evangelization. I don't, maybe that's a kind of naive thing to think, but it can bring us to the point where we ask the question about the meaning of our being, the meaning of our existence. And that's what I think it does. I've often said that what the ecological crisis does for us is to use nature and nature's no as judgment. And so really, it's the judgment of God. And from my point of view, it's been very difficult to get anybody to, or many to ask the question, a lot of young people are, the question of what we're doing in this culture. But it seems to me that the question of energy provides the occasion for us really to ask that question.
Do you want the question to be asked on the individual level, on the cultural level, or on the species level?
Well,
I think
the question finally has to be asked at the level of the creation. I was going to read Psalm 104, where the creation was there, God had placed it there for the benefit of the animals too. I mean, he provided for the animals. You've got to go beyond the species, it seems to me, to deal with this adequately. I just believe you've got to go beyond the species, period, in terms of the creation. Now, that's a debated point, I think, in theology as to whether the earth is simply for the benefit of our species, or whether the earth is for everything that's been created. See, I really, I guess, if you pressed me hard, would find it difficult to deal with anything individually. Now, there's a sense in which you've got to deal with everything individually, because you are finally responsible. But I assume a kind of body image, a Pauline body image, that we are parts of each other, and we finally deal with everything as the body of Christ. I look at it as a great day. It's really maybe the most exciting time in the last 400 or 500 years to live, in terms of the possibility of getting free from Western civilization, you know, free from its domination. It's a real possibility. We probably ought to break so we can get in line for meal.